It was just getting dark when Christian and I hopped on the train. The weather was really starting to get nice, and those dreadful gray months of Windy City winter were starting to feel like some bad dream that I was finally waking up from. Christian and I chatted excitedly during the ride. We complained about the idiots who lived on our hall, speculated about the upcoming assassin game between us and the 11th floor, and marveled at the irritatingly unfunny absurdity of that day's Nancy cartoon. It was Thursday night, and we both had classes in the morning, but neither of us cared. In a couple of hours, in a small club in the shadow of Wrigley Field, Lena Lovitch would take the stage. Christian had saved my life. If it wasn't for his sanity, my own would have gone AWOL, and I would have tried to fly away home off the top of the large hotel that had been purchased by the University of Chicago and converted into a dorm. One day, while I was sitting glumly alone in my room and looking out the window, Christian came over to visit. He and I had run into each other a few times, being on the same hall, and he and Martha were the only two I trusted to watch me rehearse my dance solo, but we never really sat down and talked. He seemed cooler than most of my other hallmates, not much of a recommendation, granted, and I don't know what prompted him to come a-callin', but I'm glad he did. I was in pretty dire straits, facing another semester in hell with no possibility of parole, and I had just finished a tape collage about my feelings doing time at the U of C. It was a totem, the kind of creative expression that meant so much to me and so much to my friends back in the real world, and so little to the soulless zombies of this forsaken ice planet. Sensing that I could trust Christian with this, too, I played it for him. It was more than me playing him a little something I'd put together. It was really me throwing a lifeline out to him.
Is there anybody out there?
Fortunately, he grabbed onto it and pulled me in, and from that day on, we started spending a lot more time together. We walked from the station to the club. It was a beautiful night, the kind that makes you glad to be alive. And we were young and dumb and... As much as I don't miss the deadlock of winter that the northern Midwest offered, it did give you a wonderful feeling of rebirth when spring finally came. Something that never really happens in a climate in which the only way to tell the seasons apart is to check the news and see whether Malibu is on fire or sliding into the ocean. There was a small cluster of people gathered around the entrance, and we got in line. There is a theory that when your body or mind really needs something, that something will appear. Whether it's biological, I suddenly got an uncontrollable urge for cottage cheese and orange juice about a month after I moved to New York City, or psychological. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance appeared out of nowhere at just the point in my life when I needed it the most. Apparently, during the spring of my junior year in high school, I needed some new music in a serious way. I had relatively recently waded into the waters of popular music and had found a tiny niche of orchestral electronic music that spoke directly to me, but most of the rock idiom left me kind of cold. I had discovered a few groups on my own that made me think there was more out there than what dripped out of my radio, but the process of finding these bands was very hit or miss. Suddenly, that spring of 1981, music poured out of the cosmos into my arms. A guest dance teacher at the Interlochen Arts Academy showed up with impeccable taste in unusual modern music and turned me on to many of what soon became my favorite groups: Kraftwerk, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Brian Eno and David Byrne. One day, while taking a shortcut through the girls' dorm, I ran into an acquaintance who suddenly and without provocation ran into her room and returned with a stack of records for me to listen to. Later, for no apparent reason, another girl that I only marginally knew came up and handed me an album, said I could keep it, and walked away. The album cover featured a strange black and white photograph of a robust-looking woman in a dark pea coat with her hands folded over her chest. On the back, more pictures of her in provocative poses, hands over her heart, peering into a crystal ball, communing with some mysterious bald-headed figure. Her name was Lena Lovitch, and the album was called Stateless. Lena Lovitch and her partner, Les Chappell, came from Detroit, but they came from Detroit by way of Pluto. He was young and bald in an era when that was far from cool. And she had long Medusa-like snakes of thick braids sprouting from her head. She looked and sounded vaguely Slavic and forged an entirely new type of identity for a female singer fronting a rock band. She wasn't sexy like Debbie Harry of Blondie. She didn't rock like Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders. She wasn't scary like Nina Hagen or Patti Smith. But she had an astonishingly powerful voice and a provocative presence, and fearlessly followed her own muse, even when it took her far from any recognizable landmarks. She hiccuped and growled and yodeled her way through quirky songs about alienation and love, although love in her hands sounded more like a curse than a blessing. And to top it off, she played the saxophone. She was unlike anything I or anybody else had ever seen. In 1979, she was signed to legendary new wave indie label Stiff Records. "If it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a fuck," was one of their more memorable slogans, and her first album, Stateless, was released.
The writing's on the subway wall. I'm sorry that I never called. I never phoned or wrote to you. It's silly 'cause I wanted to. Oh yes, the subway wall sadly seems to say it all. It's my mistake, I know that now. A bit too late to cry.
Stateless is a glorious record and helps show that anything was possible in this brave new wave. If there was room for a powerfully strange alien yodeling her way through airless versions of old Tommy James songs, there was room for everybody. In fact, her version of his bubblegum classic, I Think We're Alone Now, gives it a creepy edge that's entirely missing from the frothy original. In his hands, the song sounds like what it ostensibly is, the yearning of young lovers to spend some intimate time alone, a la the Beach Boys' Wouldn't It Be Nice. In her hands, it sounds dark and foreboding, like something a rapist whispers to his victim. Even the opening track, with the reassuring title Home, turns out to be more about the seething underbelly of domestic bliss than the shiny, happy surface. Her biggest hit came from this album, and is the track that most people know her for, if they know her at all. Called Lucky Number, it is a love song of sorts. An and was covered and translated by Nina Hagen, who may ultimately be her closest musical cousin. It's catchy and quirky and immediately established her unusual vocal style, and also immediately established her as someone who would never really break open the charts. Stateless is split between originals and covers, although her powerful musical persona makes everything sound of a piece. The album closes with her version of Nick Lowe's Tonight, a regal anthem to the power and possibility enshrouded in the night. It is a song I played over and over again while getting ready for Honors Convocation, the last big event at Interlaken before graduation, and the starting gun for the biggest night of partying of the year.
There's a place that I know, a secret place where I sometimes go. If you wanna know where, we'll go there. So don't hesitate, 'cause although it ain't late, we still can.
Lena Lovitch's second album, Flex, found her sharpening her unique musical vision. A powerfully strange album, she sounds even less of this earth than she did on Stateless. The more traditional rock elements have been stripped away even more, and the album is full of unsettling atmospherics and almost mythical musings. The opening track, Birdsong, sets the stage. A low, ominous, pulsing electronic drone creeps in, laying a foundation over which Lena trills an impossibly high, yodeling bird call. The band, all bass and airless rhythm guitar, kicks in, and the album is off and running.
Thank you.
Flex is even more alienated than stateless, and her unconvincing stabs at love songs have been dropped entirely, starting with this opening song about a bird who tells Lena of her lover's infidelities. But the song really kicks into maximum weirdness during the chorus, when a deep Slavic male chorus comes wordlessly in, anchoring Lena's stratospheric flights of vocal gymnastics. Contrast is wonderful and is repeated throughout the album, which ranges in material from the geeky Egghead to a song about Joan of Arc that sounds at points like a game show theme. Flex, like Stateless before it, also splits the tracks between originals and covers, and again, the covers are twisted around so completely as to sound like originals. One of those covers was the first song I had ever heard by Lovitch, during a dance performance by two visiting teachers from New York City during my sophomore year in high school. Called You Can't Kill Me, it's a strange post-apocalyptic song full of spidery guitars and bone-dry lurching rhythms that explodes into a vast soundscape that feels like the end of some epic Russian film with lines of soldiers marching hopelessly across the frozen tundra.
Can't kill we.
Another covered song on Flex is, like Nick Lowe's song on Stateless, an homage to the healing powers of the night. That also employs a wonderful technique of rhyming the first part of each line instead of the last. The song goes on to say how they will fool you and deceive you and keep you from the truth. In a neat reversal, the night is the time when their lies become visible. It is the part of the day when you can wake up from their poisonous dream. This was Tina's favorite song. She was my first girlfriend, a beautiful petite blonde dancer who, like many beautiful petite blonde dancers, was a little unbalanced. Being a dancer, especially a young ballerina, is an extremely stressful occupation, and much of your time and energy is spent trying to control your body and keep it from growing. It's perfect for masochistic control freaks with unrealistic romantic fantasies, and more often than not, that's who it attracts. Dancers also, as a side note, are some of the hardiest partiers I've ever met. This surprises most people, who assume that dancers want to take great care of their body at all times. But the extreme discipline required to be a dancer often leads to a need for extreme indiscipline. And most of the dainty, fragile-looking waifs I knew in the dance department could drink or smoke or snort you under the table. Anyway, this is not to say that Tina was an insane party freak. But she did put a lot of pressure on herself, and, like many of her colleagues, resorted to dangerous practices to keep her weight down to its unrealistic number, and the sheer exhaustion, not to mention the malnutrition, that this engendered often left her a little emotionally fragile. She was also way ahead of me on the cynicism curve. In high school, I still thought that people were basically good and life was meant to be celebrated. She hated people, and life, for her, was more about enduring than enjoying. She had a dark side, and her best friend Robin would encourage her to wallow in it, much to my dismay and frustration. So while I was trying to reassure Tina and get her to be open and positive, Robin was encouraging her to shut down and turn against everyone. "Kill them all," was her cry, and Tina quickly adopted it. Robin also had a blinding crush on my roommate Eric that just made everything all messy for a while there. One weekend, early in February, Eric returned from a trip home with a couple of bottles of alcohol, rum and vodka, and we gathered at our usual table for Saturday night dinner and made plans for sharing it. Due to the perverse tradition of Interlaken, classes run from Tuesday through Saturday, so Saturday night is the big start of the weekend. We needed something to mix the rum with, and being broke, couldn't spare the change for sodas. So I went upstairs to health services and complained that I had a cold, which was usually enough to get them to write you a note to get a big can of apple juice from the cafeteria to take back to your room. Not today. For whatever reason, they decided to give me an entire physical, and after poking and prodding and measuring and peering for half an hour, determined that I wasn't sick at all and sent me on my way, sans juice. So Eric and I signed Robin and Tina into our rooms and brewed a pot of tea so we could make hot rum tea to drink. You may never have heard of drinking hot rum tea, and there's a reason for this. It is extremely nasty. But we were determined, and after a couple of cups, we were all feeling pretty giggly. Then Robin excused herself to go to the bathroom, and the weekend, which started off so promisingly, went with her, straight into the toilet. After a couple of minutes, we noticed that she wasn't coming out, so Tina went over and knocked on the door and asked if she was all right. A wailing sob came from the other side of the door. Robin's unrequited love for Eric mixed with the rum tea and sent her over the edge, and she refused to unlock the door and come out. Tina pleaded with her for half an hour, but she wouldn't budge. Irritated, I left them all there and went to my work-study job, setting up chairs and taking tickets for the weekly Saturday night movie. I was pretty drunk, but managed to hide that fact from my supervisor, one of the strictest resident advisors on campus. I set up the chairs and took my place at the door so I could collect tickets, but I was itchy waiting for the movie to start so I could go find out how the real drama was unfolding back in my room. Eric suddenly stopped by and said that Robin had finally come out of the bathroom just about the time that Tina passed out from too much rum and too little food. He went for a walk with Robin to try to calm her down, and then she burst into tears again and went running off into the woods. Irritated, Eric went back to the room and found it empty, so he came over to see if I knew anything. I didn't, so he stamped in frustration and took off. A few minutes later, Robin showed up, reeking and reeling, and started sobbing again about Eric while trying to kill herself eating tacks. I quickly, and not too gently, pushed her into a side room away from the prying eyes of the RAs, always eager to bust somebody, and collared my friend Dave to help me keep her hidden and alive until I was finished taking tickets and could deal with her. But she proved too much of a handful for him and escaped before I was finished. When I got back to my room, it was empty. As it turned out, that was just the beginning of what quickly turned into the worst weekend of my high school career. Before classes started up again on Tuesday, Tina was abducted and molested by some of my hallmates, Eric got alcohol poisoning, Dave got suspended, and I got into a screaming fight with my work-study supervisor that almost got me into a fist fight. And come Monday afternoon, I was riding around in the frozen wasteland of rural northern Michigan, severely hungover and being humped by a huge white dog while driving miles with a stranger who had picked us up after our car had died unceremoniously on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. All in all, not a good weekend. But I digress. Lena Lovitch offered Tina a musical model of dark female power, and Tina eagerly lapped it up with the teary relief of finding a kindred spirit.
I take disasters in my stride. They don't upset me. Ooh, and those that mean me harm. I'm sorry that they met me. But what would I do without you?
What would I do?
What would I do?
Lena was strong and different and did things her way and didn't give a damn what other people thought, and Tina treasured her and held her close, often including quotes from her in her perfumed notes she left almost daily in my mailbox. Unfortunately, the severe individuality and take-it-or-leave-it stance of Lena Lovitch's vision was reflected in her shrinking sales numbers, as most people decided to leave it. Not only were there no hits from Flex, there was no way any of the songs could ever be a hit, so individualistic and quirky were they. So after Flex, Lena was in trouble with Stiff Records and her career was in jeopardy. After the flush of getting into the club wore off, Christian and I started getting bored. The room filled up to capacity, and everybody was milling around, impatiently waiting for the show to begin. 9 o'clock came and went without a peep, and so did 10 o'clock, and eventually 11 o'clock. People were starting to get irritated. It wasn't an ugly irritation, no threat of riot, just the natural impatience of people standing around doing nothing for 2 hours. We got another round of beers and dug in. Unwilling to release another full album of anti-hits, Stiff begrudgingly agreed to release an EP of new songs from Lena to see how it would do in the marketplace. Although she was still off on her own personal trajectory, the EP featured a catchy song given to her by wunderkind Thomas Dolby called New Toy. Did I ask for your love? Did I ask for your dedication? I don't want your love. I don't want your affection. But I've got to have the car. I need it for the week. I've got to have the stereo. A couple of delicious. The EP sold well, and New Toy got some radio play, and a new full album was given the go-ahead from Stiff. Finally, a little after midnight, the lights went down and a band took the stage. Relieved and excited, the crowd burst into cheers and applause. It was just the opening act, but everybody was glad that there was finally something going on, and they yelled while the band kicked off their set with a bleak new romantic synth-pop tune in the soft cell mold. Really pretty bad. But hey, at least there was a band playing and the crowd was happy about that. Plus it meant that Lena would soon take the stage. The opening band played another song, I guess, but it sounded exactly like the first one they played. The crowd started getting less charitable with their cheers. By the end of the third Carbon Copy song, the crowd was booing lustily. Get off the stage! You suck! Lena! 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 The singer thanked everyone for their enthusiasm. I don't know if he couldn't tell everyone was booing or if it was just the old show must go on ethos at work, and they launched into another rendition of the same song. Their set was short, but not short enough, and when they finally called it quits, a giant cheer went up from the crowd. Lena's third, and as it would turn out, last album for Stiff was by far her most fan-friendly release, No Man's Land. Energetic, synthetic, and easy on the ears, the lyrical content is still pretty far out there. She even goes so far as to explicitly state that the Blue Hotel, Earth, is a nice place to visit, although you wouldn't necessarily want to live there. As is her pattern, she covers a few songs, including a questionable love song from Holland's Meteors called It's You, Mein Schmerz, Schmerz being German for pain, and another couple from Fingerprints' Jimmy O'Neill. No Man's Land features her warmest, most inviting production, and includes her bounciest, bubbliest tune, the gloriously infectious Maria. No Man's Land also features the marvelously rhythmically obtuse Walking Low, which, even though I've listened to it hundreds of times, still evades my ability to count it out. The album ends with a beautiful and stirring, but somewhat melancholy instrumental tag at the end of Rocky Road, which sounds just like end credit music. As this was, for all intents and purposes, her last album, that's exactly what it is, a final bittersweet farewell to a long and winding road. She did come out with another album almost 10 years later, but it's embarrassingly bad and immediately forgettable, and I prefer to ignore it and focus on her trilogy for Stiff as being her real career. No Man's Land was in heavy rotation on my stereo during my year at University of Chicago. Probably Peter Gabriel's Security was the only album I played more, and Lena was touring that spring to support that album. My asshole roommate David took a shine to it and used to taunt me with his fondness for it. He thought that I thought that Lena was too cool for him and felt that the fact that he liked it was a badge of his coolness. It's like the time I got him high for the first time and he freaked out and punched me in the face and then, the next day, asked if, since he had now smoked pot, didn't that make him cool? Not quite. If you have to ask if you're cool, chances are good that you're not. Since I hated him so much, and he suddenly glommed onto something precious to me, I may have soured on Lena and moved on to things that were harder for him to like, but I wasn't going to let his enthusiasm spoil a perfectly good record, so I just ignored him and kept playing it. Finally, at close to 2 in the morning, Lena and her band took the stage. At that point, we had all been standing around for 5 hours and were tired and cranky, but she was so exciting and so good and so energetic that all was forgiven by the end of the first song. She was just as strange in person as she seemed on her albums, with her piercing dark eyes and her long braids woven throughout with dozens of pieces of bright yellow fabric, and her phenomenal voice was in fine form as she hiccuped and yodeled her way through the set. She roamed the stage like an exotic leopard while her band bounced and shimmied around her. Her show was so good, and the band so energetic, and the music so stunningly original that the whole room was lifted out of the drab, gray city of Chicago and nestled into her alien home planet for a couple of hours. She played 3 or 4 encores, and when the band finally stopped around 4 in the morning, we were deliriously happy and frightfully exhausted, and went out into the pre-dawn, humming and buzzing and happy to be alive. It was, all in all, the best concert I've ever attended. And it was followed the next night by one of the worst. But that, as they say, is another story.
Shine on. I'll be waiting.